This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of June 1st, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Krieg DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. IBJ's sixth annual innovation issue was released over the weekend, which has become an opportunity for us to step back and see where our economy is headed and how Indianapolis area businesses and researchers are keeping us on the cutting edge. Of course, our culture reveres inventors and other innovators, bestowing legendary status on folks like Thomas Edison and Henry Ford and the Wright brothers, to Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. More often than not, though, innovation is the fruit of many people and organizations working behind the scenes. Central Indiana has developed a reputation as fertile ground for innovation in the energy and transportation sectors, and in many cases, you can trace that back to groundwork laid by the Energy Systems Network. If that doesn't ring a bell, that's on purpose. The folks running the show prefer to do so in the background. But it has been a catalyst for high-profile projects and initiatives that include the recently announced 2021 autonomous IndyCar race at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, adoption of electric buses by Indigo, the now-shuttered Blue Indy electric car sharing service, and the Battery Innovation Center outside Crane Naval Base in southern Indiana. Energy Systems Network was launched by the Governor Mitch Daniels administration in 2009. The basic idea was to create a not-for-profit that would spawn collaborations between firms in the energy and transportation sectors, as well as educational institutions. It's a sister organization to similar groups that are dedicated to advancing specific sectors of Indiana's economy, like TechPoint and BioCrossroads, and they're all under the umbrella of the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership. But ESN is still a fairly modestly sized group with about 10 employees and an annual budget of about $2 million to $3 million. But over 11 years, it has generated about $750 million in direct investments in ESN-related projects from public, private, and philanthropic sources. I spoke with CEO Paul Mitchell last week to get a better sense of this powerful generator behind so many high-profile projects. So joining us in the IBJ podcast virtual studio is Paul Mitchell, CEO of Energy Systems Network. Paul, thanks for making time to speak with us.
I'm glad to be chatting.
So let's say that you and I met on an elevator back in 2009, and I asked you like what you do for a living. And you said, hey, I'm a part of this new initiative called Energy Systems Network. What, in a nutshell, what do you have told me is the mission?
Yeah, so you know, the true elevator pitch depends on how many floors we're trying to go up to determine.
We're in the Empire State Building.
Yeah, so we got a little bit of time. So ESN was stood up to try and advance the development and commercialization or deployment of new energy and transportation technologies within the state of Indiana, and to do so in a way that would hopefully generate investment and jobs and positive economic development. So not just for the benefit of the environment, but also to create economic progress.
Another way to think of the question is, you know, why does Indiana need an energy systems network?
So Indiana, you know, has a long history of being a state that makes things and builds things. We're such a manufacturing intensive state. We're also this crossroads of America. So we have lots of trucks and cars and freight that are passing through our state. And so energy as an input, whether it's your electric bill or the gas you put in your cars, is an important part of our economy. It's a major input, a major cost of production. And so if for nothing else, it's critical that we are developing and deploying these new technologies and solutions to make sure that we can continue to support our manufacturing economy, our transportation economy, in a way that is both sustainable from an environmental standpoint and as much as we can to keep it cost effective and to try to maintain at least control over rising energy costs. It's not something you can control at a state level. There are forces around the world that are outside of our control, but you can at least try to manage that cost. So it's critically important, I think, particularly in Indiana.
So if I walked into the office right now, and you guys have a staff of about 10, is that right?
Yeah.
So what would I see people doing?
The majority of our work is facilitating collaboration and coordination among technology companies and industry. So it would depend a little bit on the day, but it wouldn't be odd for you to come in and see a group of 10, 15 people where some are our staff at ESN, but others are staff and engineers and executives from utility companies. Maybe it's Duke Energy and Vectren sitting there with individuals from Cummins and Heritage Group talking about some technology challenge or market challenge, and doing a brainstorming workshop type session to identify what are solutions to that challenge. So we try to keep our work as collaborative as possible by bringing different industry perspectives together in order to come up with projects and ideas for projects that we can then implement.
So just for clarification for everybody who's listening, so Energy Systems Network is not in the business of generating energy. Right? You're not manufacturing anything. You're not writing software. You're not performing a service for customers. You're not putting up solar panels or big wind turbines along the highway. This is a not-for-profit that helps in the work of collaboration, helping public entities like governments and universities collaborate with businesses to solve energy problems.
That's correct. Although every one of the types of businesses that you just described are the people we actually work with, right? So right. We collaborate every day with people who build engines like Cummins, or now they're building battery technology for electric buses. We collaborate with the utilities that produce and sell energy. So we have experts on staff who come from those industries and are very familiar with the technology and have done manufacturing, have gone out and built solar farms. But in terms of our business, no, we are there to facilitate those projects among those partners.
Well, let's talk about some of the projects, because that's probably a good way to kind of get a grasp of the range of things that ESN is involved in. And let's start with one of the most recent ones, if not the most recent, and that's the Indy Autonomous Challenge.
The Indy Autonomous Challenge is a $1 million prize competition for university-based teams to automate and race fully autonomous, meaning self-driving race cars around the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in a head-to-head race on October 23rd, 2021. So on that date, there will be hopefully many autonomous race cars lined up. And there will be a race, and the winner of that race, assuming they can hit all of the requirements to win the prize, will be awarded a $1 million prize. So we have now 37 universities comprising 31 teams from around the world that have signed up for the challenge, and they are already now being given their simulation software where they can begin to develop their computer algorithms and software that will essentially be the brains of these cars. And then in parallel, we are working with companies like Dallara, which has operations here in Indianapolis, as well as Clemson University's ICAR Institute and other partners such as Aptiv, which has some operations up in Kokomo, to build the autonomous race cars that will then be able to be automated by the software developed by the university teams. Wow. So it is a major undertaking that will showcase autonomous vehicle technology and the best and brightest minds from around the world here in Indianapolis.
So these are race cars, and we'll look at these and go, yeah, that looks like an Indy car. There's no driver, and it's going around The Oval.
180 miles an hour, maybe 200 miles an hour around the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, racing against other
cars. Wait, did they have to go all 500 miles?
No. So it is a 20 lap race. It just long enough to show that the technology can work and work effectively, but there won't likely be pitting and it's not going to be a full 500 mile race.
And what's the point? How does this help India?
Yeah, that's a good question. Besides the fact that it's just really cool to think about and think about whether it's possible. Autonomous vehicles are becoming not just a thing of the future, but a thing of the now, right? We are starting to see autonomous vehicles deployed in cities across the country. We are seeing them used for passenger vehicles, for ride sharing. We're seeing them used in the trucking industry. And it's going to become a major part of the future of transportation technology. One of the challenges, and there are many, but one of the challenges for autonomous vehicles is being able to maintain their operations safely and securely at very high speeds. So it's one thing to automate a vehicle that's traveling 10, 15, maybe even 30 miles an hour on city streets. It's another thing to manage those vehicles when they may be traveling 70, 80 miles an hour on a highway and looking to pass other cars. And so that challenge is one that utilizing motorsports and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway as a platform to really push to the very edge what can be done with automation by utilizing race cars is going to help further the state of technology. You just think about how quickly a driver has to make a decision when they're traveling at 180 miles an hour. That computer is going to have to make those same kind of decisions. And so the speed of making decisions based on sensors and information that's coming into the computer really pushes the envelope of where that technology is today.
Yeah. What if they all spontaneously make the decision that it's in everybody's best interest to drive at 30 miles an hour?
Yeah. And we'd have a really slow race. You know, maybe they do that until the very end and then somebody sprints to the finish. No, I think they'll go full speed.
So then what is ESN's role?
We were the organizers of this challenge in close partnership with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Doug Bowles and Mark Miles and their whole organization have been hand-in-hand partners of ours from day one in envisioning this. And really for them, it brings back the history and the legacy of the track as a proving ground for automotive innovation and technology, which it has been for, you know, over 100 years. So we are the organizers. We developed the rule set. We have raised the funding for the prize money. We have gone out and recruited the universities to inform them about the challenge and educate them on it. And then we will essentially be the one that provides the grant funding or the winning dollars, the prize money to the university, and are kind of orchestrating all aspects of the challenge.
Let me go back to, I think, one of the first initiatives of the network, the Hoosier Heavy Hybrid Partnership.
Yeah, mouthful.
That's a lot of words.
That was our first project. So that's going all the way back to, you know, 2009. At that time, hybrid vehicles were common for passenger cars. The Prius and all kinds of other vehicles had done that in the passenger car industry. But hybrid was still pretty new for larger trucks and buses. They existed, but they weren't as common. Rising oil prices at that time, rising fuel prices was increasing the demand for more fuel efficient, heavy duty trucks. So you think about buses, you think about refuse vehicles or garbage trucks, you think about delivery trucks that are traveling around for, you know, a FedEx or a UPS. And Indiana has a long history in manufacturing the components that go into heavy duty trucks. Famous companies in Indiana like Cummins and Allison have been building transmissions and engines for, you know, many, many years. Delphi was developing and building battery technology and power electronics. and Rimi, which is now I believe acquired by Borg Warner, but at the time was independent, was developing electric motors. So we saw this and we said, what if we got the executives at the CEO level and at the corporate technology level together and discuss the possibility of partnering with one another so that they would develop these components, not in isolation, but actually in a way that would collaborate. Not requiring the companies to merge by any means, but to actually facilitate their individual technology development in a way that would be complementary and where they could share knowledge and information. So that formed the basis for the Hoosier Heavy Hybrid partnership between those four companies, Cummins, Allison, Rimi, and Delphi. And it just so happened that as that partnership was being formed, we went into the Great Recession of 08, 09. So what had originally started out as a, hey, we should form this partnership and maybe we will co-invest, we quickly began looking at going after federal grant funding that was part of the stimulus. And we're very successful. There was several hundred million dollars, I think around $200 million that was secured in grants to those companies I mentioned. In large part, the success of those grant applications included their partnership and their collaboration within this Hoosier Heavy Hybrid partnership. Mm-hmm. And the results of that were that you saw the development of components that were going into more hybrid vehicles, the Allison hybrid bus that's a common vehicle that we see on the streets here in Indianapolis and in cities around the country, used a lot of those components. And I think even today, Cummins launch of their electric powertrain business, you can tie some of the achievements of that back to their early work in hybrid technology in the mid-2000s.
From this sort of common point, these companies were able to develop their own kind of product lines that have ended up being big parts of their business.
Correct. And we were sort of fortunate that they were complementary. It turns out that each one was manufacturing a part that you need to put together in order to have a full powertrain. So the engine, the transmission, the power electronics, and the electric motor make up the primary ingredients, if you will, of a hybrid system.
Do you need to understand all this stuff when you're talking to these guys?
I don't, but I have to have people around me that do. My job is to understand just enough to make sense of it and to articulate the value proposition.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Krieg DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Krieg DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Krieg DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.kriegdevault.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. We're speaking with Paul Mitchell of Energy Systems Network, which has quietly helped guide some of Central Indiana's most innovative initiatives. Another one of your first initiatives, I think, was Project Plug-In.
Yes, Project Plug-In was kind of a catch-all term that we used for all of the work that we have done around the deployment of electric vehicles and supporting charging infrastructure within Central Indiana. So we set out in 2009 with this goal of making Central Indiana a leader in the development and deployment of electric vehicle technology. And we did that because Indiana actually already had a long history in battery technology development with Delco Rimi and later Delphi. We had done a lot of the first modern electric vehicle, the EV1 developed by General Motors. A lot of that work was done up in Castleton, Indiana, by GM at the time. So there was a long history and legacy there, and we wanted to build on that. I think we can say that that initiative was one of our greatest successes. We were able to successfully deploy some of the first charging stations, I think the first 125 charging stations in the state in 2009 timeframe when they were first, electric vehicles were first coming out. We did that partnership with Indianapolis Power and Light, Duke Energy, We were also able to deploy some of the first electric vehicles into corporate and public fleets. I think, in fact, the very first electric vehicle used in a government fleet in America was in the winter of 2009. And it was deployed with the state in the state government fleet in the wintertime. And we did it in that wintertime because we knew that Nissan Leafs were going to be coming out early in 2010. And we wanted to beat that to be the very first to deploy electric vehicles. And then so that has culminated then as projects matured and grew and the interest in the technology grew, that led to things like the deployment of electric car sharing with Blue Indy in Indianapolis. Which was, you know, available for a number of years, as well as the city's deployment of some plug-in and hybrid fleet vehicles in Indianapolis. And then most recently, the planning and development of the Red Line, where we were early advocates for making sure that the Red Line was an electric system and not a diesel system, which I think has been a real success story. I mean, while there have been challenges in sort of the rollout of the Red Line, the fact that it utilizes battery technology and that these buses are quiet and they don't give off a lot of heat and they don't, you know, create black smoke when they stop at the stops and pull off, is all a tribute to the benefits of electric propulsion.
So these are a lot of different projects with a lot of different groups.
And yes, ESN played a central role in kind of the planning and development of all of those activities. And we did so under the auspices of this Project Plug-In moniker with this central goal of making Indianapolis and central Indiana a leader in the deployment of electric vehicles. The fact that we were awarded, the city of Indianapolis was awarded a visionary award from the Global Association of Electric Vehicle Technology in the 2012 timeframe, I think was a real point of inflection where we could point and say, look, the work we've done has been successful and is being recognized globally. In a location and in a community that you know, might not be top of mind for people as they think about electric vehicles, you know, you immediately think, well, maybe San Francisco or somewhere like that. but in fact, we've done a lot here in Indianapolis that were first and were innovators.
Yeah, I think Blue Indy, I think it was maybe the second city either in the country or in the world.
It was the first in North America, yeah. The first in the U.S., first and largest, and then the second site was planned for L.A. You know, and Blue Indy, while it lasted as long as it did, I think is a success in the sense that it brought exposure to the technology. It provided a new transportation option for people in Indianapolis. And I think the legacy is yet to be fully understood because the fact that all of those sites now have electricity and telecommunications at the curbside, I think the future could lead to the reuse of those sites for other transportation options, other innovations. And so I think the investment in the infrastructure will have a lot, many have value for years to come.
Yeah, for folks who are listening from outside of Indianapolis, Blue Indy was a service that was owned and operated by a French company, Bolloré, which was very interested in transportation and electric transportation. It ran for about 4.5 years and just recently kind of discontinued the service.
Yeah.
I think they had more than 200 vehicles and almost 92 charging stations across.
No, 90 sites. So each site had 5 charging stations. So something more like 300 charging stations and 200 plus vehicles, probably at its peak. And, you know, their model, which was originated in Europe and did very well for a number of years in the 2010, 11, 12, 13 timeframe, that business model was really upended a bit by ride sharing. So when Bolloré Group developed the concept of point-to-point car sharing and used electric vehicles, Uber and Lyft were just getting founded, right? They weren't really around. And so there was a belief and a feeling at the time that car sharing would be something that would take off in a way that we've now seen ride sharing, which is, you know, slightly different. You have a different driver. It's instead of you driving the car, you're paying somebody else to drive you, really took off. And so I think, you know, had things played out differently with the battle between ride sharing and car sharing, and had consumers preferred driving themselves versus having somebody else drive them, you know, that we may see a lot more car sharing programs popping up. But the reality is that is not how things have played out. And so they've shut down their operations here in Indianapolis and in a few other locations around the world. I believe they still are operating in some cities, and will continue to do so, at least for the time being.
I think they said that in order to really to make the business model work and be profitable, they needed, I think, 15,000 members.
Yeah.
And they really maxed out at about 3,000.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe 3,000, 4,000, depending on the peak usage. And, you know, I think if you go back and you look at how many people are using Uber and Lyft, you know, it's getting to 15,000, 20,000. There's many tens of thousands of people using Uber and Lyft that started using that service around the same time that Bolloré was launching car sharing. And you just did not see the demand for car sharing take off. And that's not unique to Indianapolis. So I don't think it's necessarily a rejection from Indianapolis of the model or the technology. I don't think it had anything to do with the fact that the vehicles were electric. I think people thought that was pretty cool and you know, made it attractive. It's truly a national and even international trend. Daimler, Benz, you know, for example, got out of their car sharing business, as did BMW. So there's been a decrease in the number of car sharing business models that are operating around the world.
As you said, the legacy, at the very least, is that we have a lot of this infrastructure now for electric car charging.
Yes. And I think not just for electric car charging. I know this gets a little techie for your listeners, but when you have electricity that is brought to the curbside, and not just any electricity, but levels of electricity that can support substantial demand, whether it's car charging or other uses, and you have telecommunications brought to the curb, you essentially have intelligent curbsides in strategic locations all across the city of Indianapolis. The truth is there are a lot of different transportation technologies and business models that are being invested in and deployed around the world that make use of that kind of intelligence at the curbside, whether that's smart parking applications, whether that is pickup drop-off locations for an Uber or Lyft, whether it is a different type of car sharing service or a shuttle service, all the way to the possibility of using the sites to provide support for more permanent food trucks or food distribution sites or greenhouses and things that are available in the communities. We talked earlier about our work with autonomous vehicles. I do believe that sometime in the future, not tomorrow and probably not next year, but sometime in the future, you will begin to see autonomous vehicles used for things like Uber and Lyft. And you've already heard companies making those announcements. Where are they going to park? Where are they going to reside? How are they going to potentially recharge if they're electric vehicles? Are there docking stations and pickup locations? So that infrastructure being present is a value that will be there for years to come for the city.
One of the really interesting projects I don't think a lot of people know about is the Battery Innovation Center, which I believe is located at the Crane Base.
It's located in Greene County, very close to Crane Naval Surface Warfare Center. So the Crane Naval Base, yes. Battery Innovation Center is one of my proudest stories because it was an idea that grew out of one of our innovation workshops that I mentioned earlier, when we bring companies and technology leaders together and we said, what could we do that would help support, accelerate Indiana's battery industry? And it's an industry that has a long history, but really, what could we do to reinvigorate that industry and be important on a national and international scale? The feedback we got was that there needed to be a physical lab that companies could leverage, that no one company would have to fund it all, and it would have equipment and capabilities that no one company necessarily wanted to have on their own, but could benefit from, as well as research universities. And so out of that came an idea for what became the Battery Innovation Center, which is a 30,000 square foot state-of-the-art lab in Southern Indiana built next to Crane. We built it next to Crane in part because Crane itself has some really unique lab capabilities around battery technology that support the Department of Defense that we wanted to have close proximity to. And also Greene County stepped up and was willing to be a major underwriter through some bond financing for the lab. But as of today, the Battery Innovation Center has more than 250 customers from around the world, including big names like Facebook and Amazon and General Motors, and of course, many companies from here in Indiana, such as Cummins, who does a ton of work down there around their battery testing, certification, and development, all the way to dozens and dozens of startup companies, several of which are now incubating here in the state, either at the Battery Innovation Center or at other sites in Indiana. And it's got a staff of a dozen or so engineers and even some PhD talent that support a whole host of projects, from prototype manufacturing of batteries to testing of batteries, everything from little tiny batteries that would go into a medical device that might be some wearable or eventually in somebody's pacemaker, all the way to huge batteries that are used on the grid that would be the size of a semi-truck or larger. And it's a very unique facility, one of a kind in the world, and is now seen as really not just an asset in Indiana and nationally, but truly internationally when you look at the broad customer base.
And again, ESN's role in creating the center exactly was what?
So we were the incubator and sort of the founder of it. We put together the original incorporating documents. It is its own standalone nonprofit organization, but we help set it up and hire the initial staff and recruit the partners to provide funding and startup dollars, both from industry, from the state, and then worked with folks at the local level to provide financing.
How do you know at the end of the year whether or not you've done a good job?
Well, our board members find a way to tell us one way or another, you know. I mean, I think as any organization, nonprofit or for-profit, where you've got a board of directors, and in our case, it's made up of some really high horsepower executives and CEOs and university presidents, from Tom Linebarger at Cummins to Mitch Daniels at Purdue to Doug Esman with Duke Energy and others, John Baer with MISO. And so there, we look to them to make sure that they feel like we're providing the value that their organizations expect. I think I also respect a lot the viewpoint of staff, right? People who come and work in this industry and are dedicated day in and day out, we're blessed with some really outstanding talent at the staff level. And I can see it. If they're motivated and they're excited and they're ready to go, then it usually means things are going well. And the last thing I guess I'd say is we like to do cool stuff. We like to push the envelope. And so there's sort of that cocktail discussions that you have. And if people say, wow, that's really cool, you know, then we sort of say, okay, we must be doing something right. So, you know, if you can't get excited about autonomous race cars going 200 miles an hour around the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, then, you know, I'm not sure I can come up with anything more. We often point to a metric. We've generated about $750 million in 10 years in direct project investments of ESN-related projects. And that's a combination of public money from the federal government, from the state government, from industry, from philanthropy. And those investments, in some cases, pass through our organization, and in some cases are just made directly into the projects themselves.
Through the participation of ESN, that Correct. Much in funding has Correct. That much in investment has been made.
Correct. Right. Of projects that were designated as ESN projects. That's correct.
Energy Systems Network was founded in 2009 under the umbrella of Central Indiana Corporate Partnership. And some of the other similar organizations, for example, are BioCrossroads, which promotes life sciences in Indiana, Conexus, which promotes manufacturing and distribution, TechPoint, that promotes Central Indiana's technology community. You know, these are three groups that are pretty well known in the business community, especially BioCrossroads and TechPoint. They are attached to the large sectors of the Indiana economy. They sponsor big events. We don't hear quite as much about ESN like as a brand. Is there advantage to kind of flying under the radar, or would it be better if ESN was better?
No, it's very intentional. So our model is a little different from those organizations. One of the key objectives of, say, TechPoint and BioCrossroads, and you're seeing this now with Agrinovis, that's a newer initiative, is promotion and marketing of the sector itself. That is in their mission statement or in their kind of charter as organizations. When ESN was formed, we had that conversation as to was a role for ESN to market and promote the alternative or advanced energy industry or the transportation industry. And the feeling at that time, and I think it still is today, was that that wasn't really our mission and our core competency, that it was the development and implementation of collaborative projects. And so we want the credit in most cases for those projects to go to the companies, to go to the project partners, and not to reside at ESN. It kind of defeats the purpose if we are trying to facilitate collaboration and then we're trying to take credit for that collaboration.
My thanks again to Paul Mitchell. IBJ's Anthony Shutley has more on ESN in the innovation issue this week, which has several points of focus you might be interested in. For example, we take a deep dive into design thinking. That's the name for a particular way of coming up with products and services to solve customer problems. We also explore how implicit bias can undermine innovation. In addition, check out profiles of the Low Brothers, who are serial entrepreneurs in the field of life sciences, and Beth St. Clair, who's using the art of improvisation to foster leadership and teamwork in the workplace. You can learn more in the latest print edition of IBJ, the innovation issue, or online at ibj.com. And remember, for unfettered access to all of IBJ's award-winning business content, just hit the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast. I'm Mason King. Hang in there. We'll be back again next week. Thank you.